This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Corporate mergers and corporate spying on the program today. Also, we start a new series on high-end philanthropy from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. Marketplace is a nonprofit listener-supported service. To keep our coverage strong and relevant, please make a tax-deductible gift to Marketplace today. Your gift in any amount helps us keep you up to date and well-informed wherever you are. Donate at marketplace.org by December 31st. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Monday, the 9th of December. Great as always to have you with us. This will be, I know, small solace to travelers stuck in various airports hither and yon after the snow and ice storms of yesterday. But American Airlines is a going concern once again. The company made its way out of bankruptcy today and officially completed its merger with U.S. Airways, started trading on the stock exchanges as well. Shares gained a nifty 2.7% in their first day of trading, should you track that kind of thing. In other corporate news today, food. You ever stop and wonder how the chicken gets in your spicy chicken fajitas or the trout in your almondine? Chances are pretty good it got from farm to fork, courtesy of a company called Sysco. That's S-Y-S-C-O, not the technology company of the alternative spelling. Anyway, this one, the one we're talking about, made a deal today to buy its closest rival, U.S. Foods, for $3.5 billion American dollars, as Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith tells us.
Sysco and U.S. Foods are the two biggest food service distributors in the U.S., industry consultant Gary Steibel explains.
They are very much like a FedEx or even an Amazon of food. They are buying huge quantities of merchandise. They are shipping to any restaurant a case of this and two cases of that.
Together, Sysco and U.S. Foods ship $65 billion a year worth of ketchup, napkins, chicken wings, silverware, and just about everything else to restaurants and other eateries. This merger should streamline things, says Steibel.
Many of the customers of Sysco have also been customers of U.S. Foods, and duplicating all the windshield time, which is the time of driving trucks to and from restaurants all over the country, a lot of that will be eliminated.
Which will wipe away some excess costs, says Jack Russo, a consumer analyst at Edward Jones.
There will be cost savings generated from the merger that perhaps some of that can flow down to the customer level.
Or not. Food industry analyst Phil Lempert says don't expect to see the price of your Grand Slam breakfast drop anytime soon.
When you take two major competitors and you combine them, they don't have to compete on price anymore.
They don't have to pass that savings on to consumers either. Lempert says this merger could create more room for independent distributors, but not until the merger passes antitrust inspection next year. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Running a close second to the traditional saying about real estate, that is location, 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 is this one. A good rule of thumb is not to spend more than 30% of your income on housing. These days, though, more than half the renters in this country do just that. And the number of what are called cost burden renters is up sharply, so says a study out today from Harvard's Joint Center for Housing Studies. Kate Davidson reports now on what's making the rent too darn high.
Kurt Bemler and his wife are two of the 20 million renters who've crossed that affordability threshold. Their house in Missouri used to consume 25% of their income.
When I lost my job, it jumps to about 35%. So it's not killing us. We have had to tighten the belt a little bit, though.
Still, it could be worse for Bemler. The center's managing director, Eric Belsky, says the number of people facing severe rent burdens has grown enormously.
Now, well over one in four Americans who rent are spending more than half their incomes on rent.
more than 11 million people.
That's obviously a very significant number. It leaves them less to spend on lots of other things.
Things that they need, like food. It's no secret Americans have been renting more, driven partly by waves of foreclosure and the Great Recession. Belsky says over the last 12 years, something else has happened too. While rents have increased in real terms, the income renters bring home has dropped. Economist Christopher Thornburg of Beacon Economics wasn't involved in the study, but he says another long-term factor is the movement of people towards more expensive urban areas where they can find jobs.
And that, of course, leads to these sort of situations where more and more households are spending more and more of their income on housing.
Which may be fine if the work pays well, but if those new jobs are low-wage jobs, making your rent can be a big struggle. I'm Kate Davidson for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, traders squeaked out a win. We will have the details when we do the numbers. One of the through lines of the labor market during the Great Recession was about older workers being laid off and then not being able to find another job. There are, though, some companies that are actually trying to retain their older workers. Ashley Milne-Tite has that story.
When Patricia Reardon started as a nurse 42 years ago, she used to push pills in a little cart from patient to patient. These days, a computer dispenses the dose into tiny drawers
that have the medications in that we get for the patients. So it's pretty much immediate. We don't have to wait for the pharmacy for most things.
Technology isn't the only thing that's made life easier lately. At 62, Reardon is still working a few 12-hour shifts a week as a cardiac nurse. For years, she squeezed through narrow spaces and stepped over chairs to reach patients. Not anymore. The way her hospital near Atlanta is designed, the work is now easier on her body.
The furniture is pretty well put out through the unit so that the rooms are spacious enough that we can get around with the equipment and everything that we need to do for the patients is readily available.
Her employer, WellStar Health System, wants to accommodate its aging workforce. A third of its nurses are over 50. The new hospitals allow nurses to walk a shorter distance between patients, cut down on bending, and do their rounds on softer floors.
My patient's down in this end of the hall, and I'm going now to check and see what meds are due for 6 o'clock before dinner.
Marcy Pitt-Katsoufis directs the Sloan Center on Aging and Work at Boston College. She says other industries like retail, banking, and transportation are also courting older employees. They're providing everything from babysitting services for grandkids to training in new skills.
It's just a logical step for companies to want to be sure that all of their employees are coming to work interested in continuing to keep their skills up to date.
It may be logical, but it's still not the norm for companies to woo older workers. And those that are on the case aren't doing it purely out of altruism.
Certainly a sweet spot for most employers is to do something that demonstrates sort of an ethics, if you will, but also has some sound business sense to it.
Steve First is vice president of benefits at pharmaceutical firm Pfizer. The company provides benefits from free health and wellness consultations to paid time off for caregiving for an elderly parent.
So like to be able to provide through our programs a geriatric care assessment, the time saving is enormous. So that means less time someone's worried about a parent, more time, you know, here in the office.
First says Pfizer wants to keep its more seasoned employees enthusiastic, healthy, and give them peace of mind so they can concentrate on work. Companies also want to make sure workers' experience gets passed down. Patricia Reardon spends a lot of time with younger nurses.
And I do precept them and teach them, and they come to me with a lot of questions, and they consider me a resource on the unit.
Which isn't surprising. After all, she does have 42 years of nursing behind her. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
After a long summer of getting beat up about their role in the Edward Snowden data collection story, big tech companies seem finally to have had enough. Google, Yahoo, Microsoft, and five others have run a big full-page ad today, and they've gotten a website up and running as well, asking Congress and the White House to please do something about all that excessive surveillance. Kara Swisher is the co-executive editor of All Things Digital. Hey, Kara.
How you doing?
It does kind of seem like these companies have taken their sweet time getting around to the fact that they object to this, doesn't it?
Yes, they're very objecting altogether, and it's a pretty weak letter, I have to say. But the good thing is they all agreed on something, and they never agree on anything. So that's a mild victory, I guess.
I guess we'll call it that. It is kind of strange bedfellows as well. I mean, Microsoft has no love for Google, and I mean,
none of them like each other, yeah. Let's be honest. None of them.
What exactly are they asking for?
Well, reforms. You know, it's sort of one of these, so Washington, it's like, we want you to not be so spying. Even though a lot of them had different agreements with these agencies and were aware of some of it, I think they were surprised by the extent of it, and so they're sort of stamping their feet on that regard and trying to say this is hurting our businesses, which I think is at the heart of a lot of this stuff, is people, especially in Europe and the rest of the world, are not trusting these services, so it's a worry for their businesses.
Well, let's spin that out a little bit. I mean, if you go to their website that they set up, reformgovernmentsurveillance.com, which I'm looking
at
right here.
The catchy name of the website.
That's right. You learn a whole lot about what they don't like about what the government does. You don't learn anything about what they are doing with this self-same data that they have.
Of course. I mean, that's the irony here. I mean, they've been spying on us for years in order to sell things. I mean, it's a problem for these companies because they use this data to improve their businesses and at the same time object when the government is essentially using it to improve its business.
The question does arise, though, that if they are so up in arms about this, couldn't Larry Page at Google and Marissa Meyer at Yahoo, couldn't they just turn off the switch and say, no, we're not cooperating at all. Get a warrant or forget it.
They'll never take that step, I think. I think it'd be shocking. I mean, so there's been a bunch of those happening, you know, around smaller companies, and I think the indignancy is really real for a lot of them. In this case, they're just not going to do that. I mean, first of all, it has all kinds of legal implications, and I don't think they feel like going to jail for, you know, violating.
On a related note, you point out a piece in the Washington Post today about how morale at the NSA is just in the sewer.
Yes. Yes. People feel bad because people think they're spies, I guess.
Which is, you know, the truth.
Which is what they are. Yeah. I mean, don't be a spy if you don't want to be called a spy, I guess. But I think that the idea is that that other presidents have, George W. Bush, have supported them during times of controversy like this, and Obama hasn't apparently driven out there. And they want, you know, the president to say what you're doing, however distasteful, is important for the country, and he's not doing that, I guess, enough.
Kara Swisher is the co-executive editor at All Things Digital. Kara, thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot, Kai.
Coming up, remind me again why make a charitable contribution?
Tax deduction.
Oh. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 5 points today. That is a fraction of 1%, finished at 16,025. The blue chips did. The NASDAQ added 6 points, a tenth of a percent, closed at 4,068. The S&P 500 rose 3 points, about two-tenths percent, ended things at 1808. Cisco, the one we're talking about, SYSCO, scooped up 9 2/3% today after news it's going to take over U.S. Foods. General Electric clicked up nearly 1%. Chevron pumped in 0.8% today. Boeing, however, descended 0.4%. Time Warner unplugged itself 1.6% today. Citigroup bumped up about 1.2% today. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note down to 2.84%. And you... yes, indeed. You're listening to Marketplace. Marketplace is listener-supported. To keep our coverage relevant and compelling, please make a tax-deductible gift to Marketplace today. Your gift in any amount supports your daily dose of business insight from Marketplace, so please help us keep you up to date and well-informed wherever you are. Donate at marketplace.org by December 31st.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Tuesday. In Washington, we get a look at some data for the month of October. The Commerce Department reports on wholesale inventories and sales, and the Labor Department releases its job openings and labor turnover survey. The Nobel Prize Award ceremony takes place in Stockholm, and librarian and inventor Melville Dewey was born on December 10, 1851. You may have used his system to find a book during your library visit. You do go to the library, don't you? I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The economic word of the day today is externality. That is a cost or a benefit that accrues to someone unrelated to a particular transaction. Air pollution is the classic example, and in point of fact, that's exactly what will be at issue at the Supreme Court tomorrow. States like Ohio and Kentucky that rely mainly on coal to produce electricity are challenging a part of the Clean Air Act, the Good Neighbor policy in particular, that says they have to pay up if their pollution blows across state lines. Marketplace's David Weinberg explains.
One way to think of externalities, says public administration professor David Popp, is to imagine that you're at a neighborhood barbecue grilling steaks, and the smoke from your grill is blowing into your neighbor's yard and causing his asthma to flare up.
I'm getting the benefits of using the grill, but the harm done by the smoke is harming the person next door. It's not harming me.
This is essentially what's going on in Rust Belt and Appalachian states, where a large percentage of electricity is generated by coal. That pollution blows east. States that exceed EPA air quality standards have to reduce pollution. But for many eastern states,
part of the pollution that they have to get rid of is something they have no control over because it's not being generated within their state.
When it comes to reducing emissions, requirements vary by region, says Dallas Bertrop, a senior fellow at Resources for the Future.
Regions that have worse air quality now typically will have more stringent requirements on facilities that are located in those states.
Coal-burning states want to avoid those requirements because they have economic costs. They come in many forms, like scrubbers on coal-burning power plants, costs paid by the utilities. The EPA can also slow down permitting for new construction of industrial facilities. Bertrand says the cost being paid now is a hidden tax levied on people in the Northeast.
And that hidden tax is the health effects on people that are exposed to that air pollution.
The argument over the good neighbor rule comes down to who should pay the cost of that externality. The Midwest neighbors in this case say tighter restrictions will hurt their economy and won't make a difference in air quality. The Supreme Court will hear the arguments tomorrow. I'm David Weinberg from Marketplace.
In Ukraine today, government security forces raided opposition party offices. Vice President Biden had a phone conversation with Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych, and senior diplomats from both the European Union and the United States are on their way to Kiev to try to calm things down over there. There were massive protests this weekend over the government's refusal to establish closer trade ties with the European Union and instead maintain that country's traditional relationship with Russia. Anastasia Zanuda is a business reporter for the BBC in Kiev. It's good to have you on the program.
Pleasure.
Politics of all of this aside, what has the government said about why it would prefer to stay with the Russians as opposed to joining the EU in some kind of treaty arrangement?
Well, they said that since we have over one-third of our foreign trade based on Russia, that it's important to keep good ties with Russians, and because somehow the agreement with the European Union could affect this trade. On the other hand, we have one third of our foreign trade based in the European Union.
These protests over the last couple of days, especially now with the Lenin statue coming down and these mass gatherings in Independence Square there, it does sort of look like the last days of the Soviet Union looked. And I wonder if anybody's thinking about Western companies and multinationals saying, you know what, Ukraine's not a good place for us to be right now, and we're not going to have any foreign investment in there until you guys figure things out.
Well, actually, they were leaving Ukraine long before that, long before riots started. In last 2 years, 10 out of 14 foreign banks have left Ukraine. And I personally know three or four persons who lost their job during this year because foreign companies, sick and tired of paying bribes to tax inspectors, just left the country.
What's the economy like for the average person? I mean, are they seeing inflation? Can they borrow money? Do they have jobs?
It's quite tricky because officially our inflation is at 0%.
Officially?
At the moment. Official inflation. But I can borrow money from the bank for about 25-27% if I, for example, would like to buy a flat now. So probably this bank percent gives us some understanding of what the real inflation is in the country.
President Yanukovych has asked in the last day or so for all-party talks with negotiations, I guess, with the opposition. Is he just stalling, or do you think this might actually go anywhere?
It's really hard to say, because if he really thought of the economy and of the consequences, probably he would think twice of this decision of not signing the agreement with the European Union. This protest is not, you know, for Western money or for cheaper gas from Russia or for bread. It's, you know, protest for hope to see things changing a little bit better in the future. And if it's taken from the people, then what's the point of, you know, going on?
Anastasia Zanuda, she's with the BBC Ukraine service. I got her in Kiev. Thank you for your time.
Pleasure again.
Americans as a group give more than $300 billion to charity every year, for which many of those Americans get a break on their taxes. That charitable deduction, as it's called, costs the U.S. Treasury about $50 billion. And this week on the show, we're looking at high-end philanthropy in a series we're calling A Lot to Give. Our wealth and poverty reporter Chrissy Clark gets us going with a story about what that deduction can tell us about American giving.
On December 31st, about 10 years ago, a woman named Carol Kamatsuka was at her job at a nonprofit in Los Angeles when her coworker got an unexpected phone call. It was from a man who was at that very moment on his way to their office building.
Asked for someone to meet him on the curb in front of the office.
A few minutes later, a Mercedes pulls up. This guy gets out.
And he handed over this envelope, and in the envelope was a check for
$100,000. $100,000. Now, full disclosure, Carol Kamatsuka, the woman who told me this story, currently works for our sister station, KPCC Public Radio. But back to this story. When I heard it, my question was, what exactly was the rush? Why not wait a few days till after the holidays to give $100,000? A wealth advisor named Robert Pagliarini says it probably had something to do with these two words.
Tax deduction.
The tax deduction you can take on charitable gifts can turn the simple act of giving into something a little more strategic. Pagliarini says things start to matter that otherwise wouldn't, like when you give your money.
You want the biggest bang for your buck.
And you get a bigger bang if you donate in a year when you're in a higher tax bracket. As Pagliarini explains, if you give away, say, $100,000 in a year when you fall into the 39% tax bracket, you could shrink your taxes by $39,000 with the charity deduction. But if you're in a lower tax bracket, say 25%, your tax break is smaller, just $25,000. This rush to get the biggest benefit out of a charitable act might not be exactly what was in mind when the charity deduction first got started almost 100 years ago, but it might not be too far off. Let me set the scene. It was the Gilded Age, a time when a small group of Americans were making very large amounts of money and giving some of it away to schools and libraries and other causes they cared about. Then, in 1917, something happens.
The World War, the First World War, young Americans are drafted or volunteer, going to make the world safe for democracy.
But the war would make things unsafe for philanthropy. At least that's what a U.S. senator named Henry Hollis feared. That's because to pay for the war, Congress was in the process of hiking up the new income tax on the rich from 15% to 77% in just a couple of years. With the wealthy suddenly giving so much money to the government, Hollis worried that their gifts to charity would dry up. As he wrote bluntly at the time, people really only contribute to charities out of their surplus.
After they've done everything else they want to do, after they've educated their children and traveled and spent their money on everything they really want or think they want.
this is maybe not the way we like to think of ourselves, where we're going to give till it hurts.
That's a tax historian named Joe Thorndike with a research group called Tax Analysts. He's written about the history of the charity deduction and why Senator Hollis pushed so hard for it.
What he's saying is we're going to give when it's convenient and it doesn't hurt that much. So government needs to make sure it doesn't hurt that much. That was, in many ways, the reason behind the creation of the deduction.
Research is divided about whether the deduction really affects the amount people donate each year. But the goal of the deduction has always been clear: to incentivize charitable giving. That goal, of course, only makes sense if you think charities are good for society. Most Americans do. Not everyone, though. Joe Thorndike says skeptics of the charitable tax deduction have argued that taxes can do what charities do better.
A lot of people who believe in the value of government and believe that taxes are the price we pay for civilized society, as Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes once said, those people think, hey, it's okay. We don't need charities to do all this stuff. We'd rather have government doing it. They'll do it more efficiently. It'll be better all around.
No matter how you feel about the charity tax deduction, Thorndike says what he loves about it is how many deep questions can lead from this one tax break.
Because it touches on what private charities are doing and what government might do if those charities disappeared, it really gets at the heart of what Americans think about their government and what they want their government to do and how they want to help people and, you know, all of that.
Those aren't questions we necessarily ask ourselves directly most of the time. But around the end of December, when Americans contemplate writing a check to their favorite charity and anticipate the tax deduction that could come with it, those questions are getting answered one way or another. Robert Pagliarini, the wealth advisor, says he sees his clients answer these questions all the time in a very practical way.
And most people that I've talked to and that I work with would prefer that they direct where that money goes and to which cause it goes to, rather than simply going to the government.
Pagliarini says there was this one client his firm had once who wasn't interested in taking any deductions.
And he looked at us and said, well, I don't want to pay less tax. He felt that he was in the United States, that he almost owed it to the country that enabled him to create the wealth that he did.
But Pagliarini says clients like that don't show up very often. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
Coming up tomorrow, if you give, does it matter whether you give to things like the arts and cultural groups or to meet basic human needs?
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today, in which we learn the federal government is officially out of the car business. The Treasury Department sold what was left of its stake in General Motors today. That part of the auto bailout didn't work out so well for taxpayers. We invested $49.5 billion about 5 years ago. As of today's sale, we've gotten $39 billion out of it. That is, of course, $10.5 billion in red ink all told. Or if you want to break it down just a step further, we lost about $10 million a day on the thing. Although it does have to be said, we saved a whole bunch of jobs in the process, which counts for something. All right, we're done. That is Marketplace from APM. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner and Tommy Andres. Millie Jefferson directs the program. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.